Good to be here again with you this morning. If you take your Bibles and turn them to Genesis chapter 22. I do like to preach. This has been an eventful week for me. Wednesday was my birthday. We won't say how many. And of course, my wife is scheduled to work. She's a nurse, scheduled to work Friday, Saturday, Sunday this week. So Friday, I bought her a dozen red roses and dressed like I am right now. Went to work at the hospital and surprised her with a dozen roses. And she was real happy about that. But then if you pay careful attention to the prayer, you heard an allusion to my family. Yesterday morning, I was teaching at the college. And when I got done with that and went back to my office, there was the red light on, which means I have a voicemail. I checked the voicemail. I've come to find out my wife has two blood clots in her lung and is in the hospital. And so that's where she's at right now, and that's what that prayer was about. So I got to spend part of the day at the hospital, and will again today. But it is good to be with you today. I trust by now you found Genesis chapter 22. And so let's read the first several verses of that together. Obviously, we're breaking in the middle of the story, and we'll tell you a little bit about that later on. Starting in verse 1. Sometime later, God tested Abraham. He said to him, "Abraham, here I am," he replied. Then God said, "Take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love, and go to the region of Moriah. Sacrifice him there as a burnt offering on one of the mountains I'll tell you about." Early the next morning, Abram got up and saddled his donkey. He took with him two of his servants and his son Isaac. When he cut enough wood for the burnt offering, he set out for the place God had told him about. On the third day, Abram looked up and saw the place in the distance. He said to his servants, "Stay here with the donkey while I and the boy go over there. We will worship, and then we will come back to you." We'll be referring to more of the passage this morning, but that gives you a little flavor for it. Abraham woke up at the start from a terrifying dream in the middle of the night. Could this be real? Or was this some sort of terrible nightmare? I mean, after all, could God really ask him to sacrifice his son? His only son? The one whom all these promises have been made to? This made no sense whatsoever. It was cruel. It was heartless. But you know, the more he thought about it, the more he was sure that he had heard God speaking to him. But still, that raised problems. How could God ask him to do such a thing? It was unthinkable. And after all the promises God had made that were to be fulfilled through Isaac, well, how is that going to happen if Isaac is dead? Not only is it unjust, it makes absolutely no sense whatsoever. Why would turn God into a liar? Can you imagine the kinds of things that Satan is whispering in Abraham's ear about now? All of the reasons and all the excuses that he can come up with why he shouldn't do this? But as we see, Abraham obeys God. He trusted God when, from his standpoint, what God was telling him to do didn't make any sense. And I think there's a lesson there for us, and that's basically our point this morning, is that we should trust and obey regardless of what God tells us to do. Regardless of how cruel, how ridiculous, how impossible it may seem to be, believe it or not, God knows best. Now, if I were to ask for a show of hands, or a secret ballot even, so you don't have to be worried about peer pressure, and ask you how many people think God knows best, I'm willing to bet, if I bet, which I don't, that a vast majority of you would say God knows best. And you should do what he tells us to do. Now let me ask you, what happens in real life? Huh? What happens in your real life when you run into those kinds of situations? Let's see, let's face it, they may seem impossible, ridiculous, terrible to us, but they're nothing to what Abraham faced. And what do? Interesting question, isn't it? We might not want to answer that one, but it's certainly a good one to think about. Let's remind ourselves of the background here a little bit. Abraham's 75 years old. He's a pagan living in what today would be southern Iraq, to put ourselves in contemporary perspective. And he's grown up in an idolatrous atmosphere that worships many gods, and including gross sexual immorality that goes along with that worship. Then one day out of the blue, he hears this voice from heaven saying, "Abraham, I'm the true God. I want you to leave your family. I want you to leave your homeland. I want you to leave everything that is near and dear to you and go to where I tell you." And Abraham says, "Okay." Well, that takes a lot of faith, doesn't it? And he says, "All the nations of the world will be blessed through you, and I'll make many nations come from you." Abraham's 75 years old. His wife is 65. And they have how many children? Zero. Not a one. Now, people lived longer back then, but still, they've been married for 20, 30 years, and we got zero population growth on hand. Things don't look real well. Abraham gets to the promised land. 12 years later, he's 87. His wife is 77, and she has gone through the change. So now it is biologically impossible for her to have a child, you understand? Okay? And so, Sarah comes to Abraham one day and says, "Let's face it, I am never going to have a child. Not only have we been married these number of years and I've never gotten pregnant, but I've gone through menopause. It just can't happen. It's biologically impossible. So let's do what is culturally acceptable in that day, and that was, if a woman couldn't bear a child, it was her responsibility to provide another woman for her husband to father a child with. And legally, it would be Sarah's child." And so that's what they do. And so Abram sleeps with Hagar, Sarah's maid, and fathers a child. Then as soon as that happens, Hagar gets uppity and says, "I'm better than you because I can get pregnant and you can't." And Sarah gets real mean and angry and treats Hagar so badly that she runs away to die. So Sarah didn't act very well. By the way, you stop and think what happened in that whole thing. God had made a promise to Abraham, hadn't he? God had promised that I'll provide nations, not nation, but nations through you. Abram, at the suggestion of his wife, but we can't blame it on her because he made the decision, he decided that God needed some help keeping his own promises. I wonder, do we ever do that? Do we ever have a promise from God and then things don't happen right away? Because if you're like me, I like to see things happen, you know, right now. And when things drag on and they don't happen right away, we start thinking, you know, maybe God needs a little help. Let me get in there and help God out. Then things will work out the way God said. That's what they did. Guess what? It blew up in their face. And in this case, it's still blown up in our face. Because not only was there hostility between Sarah and Hagar, later on between Ishmael and Isaac, Ishmael is the son of Isaac, but you realize who the descendants of Ishmael are? The Arabs. Everybody fighting in the Middle East are descendants of Abraham. Islam views Ishmael, in a sense, as its founder. And one of the reasons Mecca is a holy city is because supposedly that's where Abraham almost sacrificed Ishmael. They put the story that we're reading about today, they turned it into one about Ishmael instead, which happened at Mecca. That's all because Abram and Sarah decided that God needed some help. Let me suggest to you that if God makes a promise to you, and even if things aren't happening according to your timetable, because usually they don't, by the way, it's the way God operates, keep your hands off. Don't do like they did, and like we so often do, and decide we need to help God out. Because when it does, almost always trouble ensues. Now, we may not end up creating wars between nations like happened in this particular case, but problems will happen. So trust God and don't try to help him out unless he asks for your help. So finally, after 25 years of waiting, when Abraham's 100 and Sarah's 90, the promised child Isaac is born. And Abraham is thrilled to death. And when Isaac is weaned, he follows his daddy around wherever he goes. The two are become inseparable. And he's waited a long time for this kid, and there's a whole lot of promises that are all bundled up in Isaac, you see. And he spoils Isaac rotten. And as time goes by, Isaac is becoming more important to Abraham than Sarah is. By the way, that's a no-no. If you're married, the most important person is supposed to be your spouse. Most important person. Not only is Isaac displaced Sarah as number one in Abraham's affections, he's in the process of displacing God as number one in Abraham's priorities as well. Because God should be the most important thing of all to us, and Abraham's starting to make Isaac number one. And so God decides to put Abraham to the test. And that's what this chapter is all about. Abraham's being tested as to what his true loyalties, what his true priorities are. Now you understand God is all-knowing, and so he knows what's going to happen. So this is for Abraham. And God is intervening because the way Abraham's going, if something doesn't happen, he's going to go in the wrong direction. And so he says, Abraham, and the first thing I want you to note is Abraham says, here I am. When God spoke, Abraham heard and recognized it as the voice of God. Now that is not insignificant, because I ask myself, how many times does God speak to people today and they don't even hear him? I wonder. I really do. Or how many times does God speak and people hear it, but they say, well, that couldn't possibly be God, because God wouldn't ask me to do something like that. Because Abraham easily could have gone down that route, couldn't he? But he heard God speak, and he acknowledged that it was God. Then God starts turning the screws. He's going to make this test a tough test. As was mentioned, I'm the registrar at Crown. I'm teaching 7 classes this year, too, and I'm known as the tough teacher. And so I don't make things easy. The claim is that in the long run, you learn more that way. And you stop to think about that. You learn more from the teachers that let you slide by with no effort or from the ones that made you work hard. You might have been mad at them at the time, but in the long run, they benefit you more. And so that's what God does to Abraham here. He makes it as hard as possible. He says, take your son, your only son, Isaac, whom you love. He's twisting the knife, you see, making it as hard as he can, reminding Abraham that this is the child of promise. Without Isaac, where are the promises? All those promises that I made to you, that you've been banking on for the last 25 years. You've left everything behind to follow me. And I'm asking you to give it all up and to trust in me instead of trusting in those promises. Interesting thought, isn't it? And whom you've devoted your life to, whom you love too much, as a matter of fact. I want you to take him and sacrifice him. And as I mentioned, Satan is undoubtedly whispering all kinds of things in Abram's ear about how this couldn't possibly be God. And if it was, then God is heartless and cruel and should be disobeyed and should be ignored, because that's a terrible thing for God to demand of him. But we're told Abram gets up immediately, early the next morning, and starts getting ready to go. By the way, I have often asked myself, I wonder what, if anything, he told Sarah. Can you imagine that conversation? My guess is he didn't tell her what was really going to happen. Because she could have said, not my only child, you don't. And by the way, I suspect if he'd have told her, the servants would have said, he's gone loco. They'd grab him and tie him up and toss him in the corner and say, he's a crazy old man. We're not going to let him do that. So he probably said, God has told me, given me some message, that we got to go away and we'll be back in a few days. Something like that. Which, by the way, ended up being the truth. When you stop and think about it. Abraham just didn't know all the details in the meantime. And so they head off and are going to Mount Moriah, which, by the way, is where the temple later is built. The place where sacrifices are later offered. So you see some of the symbolism there. In a sense, Isaac is a Christ figure. And we'll think about a little bit more about that in a couple of minutes. And so they're going along and they're taking how many days to get there? 3. By the way, if you actually study how far Moriah is from where they were at the time, if they really traveled hard, they could get there in 1 day. If they took a moderate pace, they easily make it in 1.5 days. So Abraham's kind of going like this. Not exactly hurrying, you know? He's obeying. He's going the way God's told him, but he's giving God plenty of opportunity to along the way to say, okay, that's good enough, Abraham. I see that you're obeying me like I said. You can go back home now. I really didn't mean it. I was just checking you. But God doesn't do that, does he? He lets him get all the way there. Then when he gets to the bottom of the mountain, he's got a decision to make. He tells the servants, you guys stay here. I and the boy will come. And who's going to return? That was the last thing I read to you. He said, we will return. He's going up there to kill Isaac. That's what God has told him. But he says, we will return. Now, he had to leave the servants there, because if he took the servants with him, they would have stopped him. I guarantee you. They would not have let him go through with it. But he says, we will return. So either Abraham's lying, or he actually believes that somehow they're going to return. Hebrews chapter 11 gives us a clue. That's the faith chapter. And in there we're told that Abraham believed God so much that he believes that if God actually went through with it and told him and had him kill Isaac, that God would raise Isaac back to life. That takes a lot of faith, doesn't it? Because after all, if God doesn't raise Isaac back to life, God's a liar. Because God has made all these promises and said that they're going to be fulfilled through Isaac. So you see what Abraham is doing is he's trusting God. He's obeying God. He says, what you're telling me to do, as far as I can tell, doesn't make a lick of sense. It's heartless. It's cruel. It's painful. From what I can see, but somehow you must know what you're doing, God. And so I'm going to go ahead and do what you say and trust that things will work out the way you have promised me. And so he goes ahead and does it. So Isaac and Abraham are going up the mountain. And wouldn't you know it, Isaac, by the way, is not the brightest person in the Old Testament by any means. But he is bright enough to figure out that something's amiss here. He says, Dad, I'm carrying the wood for the sacrifice on my back, which is interesting, carrying, because he's the sacrifice. Now you got the fire, you got the knife, but where's the sacrifice? Seems like we're missing something here. Abraham's heart skips a beat. Can you imagine what's going through his mind about then? And he says, God will provide a sacrifice. And little did he know how that was going to happen. Now when they get up on top of the mountain, now it's time to come clean. First they build the altar. Now he has to tell Isaac the rest of the story. Isaac, you're the sacrifice. Now it's generally thought that Isaac's about 13 years old now, and Abraham is 113. I point this out. Okay. How many 113-year-old men can pick up a 13-year-old boy and place him on the altar to start with? How many 113-year-old men can outrun a 13-year-old boy who doesn't want to be sacrificed? In other words, when Abraham told Isaac, God told me this, Isaac believed his dad. Because there's no way Abraham could have forced Isaac up on that altar. It was physically impossible. Isaac believed his dad when his dad told him something that seemed crazy. And I look at that and I say, oh, to have the kind of reputation for godliness that Abraham must have had, so that when I tell my family, when I tell people in my church, when I tell people at school, people or somebody else, this is what God has said, and it seems crazy, it seems impossible, it seems ridiculous, may even seem wrong, but they believe me because they know my godly character. Oh, for you and I to have that kind of reputation. Because that's why Isaac obeys his dad. So Isaac basically crawls up on the altar himself, and then his dad straps him down. His heart's beating about 200 beats a minute, right on the verge of a heart attack. Remember, he's 113 years old. He raises the knife, just is starting to lower it when God says, stop. He says, now I know that you really trust me and that I'm number one in your life. Now again, let me remind you, God knew all along this whole thing was for Abraham's sake. Because Abraham was starting to put Isaac number one in his life rather than God. And said, so now this crisis, God has brought about this crisis so that Abraham has to make a choice, and he makes the right choice. I'm going to point out a couple of things. One is that's how God frequently works. He waits till the very last second. And then he provides the answer. Then he provides deliverance. And if you're like me, I'd like it a long time before the last second. But frequently, that's what he does. And so you need to be aware of that. And all too often what happens is Christians start down the right path, start obeying God, even when he tells them to do something that seems too hard, too difficult, too painful, too wrong. But when things don't start turning out the way it's supposed to, fast enough, they bail out somewhere along the line. And that's the big mistake we make at times, because all too often, God waits till the very last second to provide deliverance. And if we bail out somewhere along the way, we never receive it. And then we say, see, I told you, I knew God wouldn't take care of me. Well, we didn't give him a chance because we didn't follow through all the way till the end. We've got to follow through all the way till the end with obedience and trust before we will really see him answer and deliver in our life. And that's exactly what Abraham did here. And of course, as you know, he turns around and there's a ram stuck in the thicket, so he sacrifices the ram instead. So he does get to make a sacrifice to God, and Isaac's life is spared. But Abraham didn't know that was going to happen. He fully expected that he was going to have to kill his son, but he believed that God would take care of things anyway. So let me suggest to you that what may often, from our limited perspective, seem to be God inflicting pain and hurt on us, God being mean to us, God being unfair, God demanding the impossible from us, may actually be a display of His love. May actually be God's attempt to put us back on the right track as far as making Him number one when we're starting to get off on the wrong track. Verse 2 of the song that was sang, the special, talked about wandering away. And of course, each time is crying for God's mercy. Good news is, God is merciful. And so what oftentimes we may view as God's being mean to us is actually His showing of love to us, trying to prevent us from doing something that is really self-destructive. Because ask yourself, what would have happened if Abraham had continued on that path of making Isaac number one and completely dethroned God? I don't want to think about it. I'm sure God would have provided salvation another way, but it wouldn't have been through Abraham's family. But it's so easy to let that happen, you know, a little bit at a time, to let other priorities slip in there, and so that God is no longer the top priority, the chief love of our life. So as we close this morning, I just want to review a couple of things with you. Remember that God loves us, and He always wants what's best for us, even when it doesn't seem that way, because it sure didn't seem that way to Abraham when God made that request to him to start with. But oftentimes, we seriously misunderstand what's best for us. We all think about that, and we got, you know, as far as what is best for us and how things should turn out, but our plans are not always God's plans. Our ways are not God's ways. As far as the heavens are above the earth, so far are His thoughts above ours. We often seriously misunderstand what God is trying to do in our life and misread the signals. It's easy for us to let other people or things get in the way and become more important to us than God. It's very easy to do. So we need to be aware of that and be on guard against that. When that starts to happen, God in His love, not in His anger, not out of revenge, not to hurt us, but because He loves us, would come along and give us a reality check like He did Abraham here. And sometimes that reality check hurts. But in the long run, it's for our good. He's trying to bring us back on the right path so we don't do something that is self-destructive. Sometimes when He speaks to us, we don't even hear Him. Or we hear Him, but we dismiss it and say, that can't be God. So we need to keep our ear tuned so that we can hear God and recognize God's voice when He speaks to us. When His plans seem so contrary to our plans, because face it, that often happens. Or if we just decide that He's wrong on something, that He's calling us to do the impossible, trust and obey. God never calls us to do something impossible. Now, God often, I would argue that if you are on fire for God, if God is number one in your life, I guarantee you that God will call you to do something that is impossible for you to do. For you to do. I can in my own self do nothing, but I can do all things through Christ who gives me strength. So it may be impossible for you, but it's not impossible for you and God. Otherwise, He wouldn't call you to do it. He wouldn't call you to be that. But if you're on fire for God, I guarantee you, He'll call you to do something that is impossible for you. So the question is, how are you going to respond? Even when it seems unthinkable or heartless and cruel, if we trust and obey, we'll discover, like Abraham did, that God really does love us and have a wonderful plan for our life, even when the circumstances don't seem to suggest that at the time. God may allow us to go through some extremely difficult times in the meantime. That's happened to me. That's happened to some of you. That's happening to some of you right now. I know that. But God still loves us. And if we stay true, if we trust and obey, if we keep Him number one in our life, we'll see that He knows best. So today I want to leave you with three simple questions. The questions are simple. The answers may not be quite so simple. Question number one is, who or what is number one in your life? Who or what is number one in your life? Now be honest. God knows. No sense in lying to yourself, because He knows anyway. Number two, what unusual, difficult, impossible thing is God calling you to do? Because if He's number one, I guarantee you He's calling you to do it. That's the way He operates. So ask yourself, what's He calling me to do? And question number three is, what are you going to do about your answers to number one and number two? Nice to talk about it, but now here's where the rubber meets the road. You know, at the close of the book of Joshua, when Joshua is about to die, he calls all the Israelites together. He reminds them of how God has delivered them in incredible ways in the past, despite their unfaithfulness to them. Then he says, "Choose you this day whom you will serve. But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord." The fascinating thing about that passage is the people all say, "We will too." And Joshua says, "Watch out. Don't make a promise you can't keep. Because there are consequences for that. So before you say me too, know what you're saying." Having said that, let me say to you, choose you this day whom you will serve. Who or what are you going to make number one in your life? But as for me and my house, we will serve the Lord. Worship team.